Author, historian, and Pulitzer Prize winner Doris Kearns Goodwin has a new book, Leadership in Turbulent Times. The book chronicles the journeys of four of our nation's presidents, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon B. Johnson. Through these histories, Goodwin explores questions of natural leadership ability versus developed ability, the relationship between ambition and adversity on leadership growth, and how leaders both perceive themselves and are perceived by others. She will be at the FDR Presidential Library in Hyde Park this Saturday at 3 o'clock. On September 29th, she'll be speaking at the Albany Book Festival at the University of Albany. And later in the day, she'll be in conversation with me at the Maple Street School for a Northshire Bookstore event in Manchester Center, Vermont at 6 p.m. And it is a great pleasure to welcome Doris Kearns Goodwin back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Joe. I'm glad to be doing it again. Absolutely.
Well, it seems as though we need a book on leadership. I don't know if that's what brought you to this point, especially in turbulent times. But given the subjects that you write about, certainly you've written about them before and you had a lot of this information and were thinking about it. But doesn't the time we are in lend to it a bit?
I actually think so. I mean, the title, Leadership in Turbulent Times, was chosen because the four leaders that I decided to focus on, Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin, and LBJ, surely lived themselves in turbulent times, in fact, far worse than ours. But the title became much more relevant in these last couple of years. So that I think that what I really hope is that by looking at these leaders and how they got through the challenges and how the citizens responded to their leadership, it does underscore the absence of that kind of leadership in our country today. And I think you need heartening examples of leadership from the past, or else we tend to accept this mean-spirited, frenetic, polarized climate as our norm. And it's not even just willful optimism to say that. I think if you look at these stories, they are evidence and proof of real norms that guided us through those greatest trials of our past. And if we've had them before, we can get them again.
You do this beautifully in showing the different styles of leadership, but what they all have in common is that they were indeed leaders. And I'm interested in, was there a definition of leadership that you were playing with?
You know, it's interesting. I've thought about that so many times. I mean, I think probably in my mind, although not putting it down because it defines it, it's still a mystery what it is, but, you know, it's the ability to mobilize a team, a country, an organization, you know, to shared goals that in the end are going to benefit and enlarge the lives of others. I mean, that's the way I see it. That's an ethical definition in a certain sense. You know, that there's all these arguments. Can Hitler be a leader? You know, certainly he was in a position of power. But if leadership has something in it in your own mind that is a positive force, then he wouldn't be in that. So those are the kind of arguments we used to have in graduate school all night long. But in my mind, it really is. There's always a bond between a good leader and the citizens. And the establishment of that bond is what allows you to mobilize them and have a sense of shared purpose to move together toward a mission that needs to be accomplished.
Let me ask a diagnostic question, and that is how the book is broken up. You have three sections, the first being on ambition and the recognition of leadership. There are four chapters, each by the first name of the individual that you're writing about, Abraham, Theodore, Franklin, and Lyndon. Then you go to adversity and growth. Then we get the last names then, Abraham Lincoln,
right.
Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, and Lyndon Johnson. And then you write about the leader in the times and how they led, and about different types of leadership, whether it be crisis management or visionary leadership or transformational leadership. Give us a sense of how you came to that way of telling the stories of these four men who, yes, shared leadership, but otherwise were very different.
Well, I think I decided to start with them when they first ran for public office, because each one of those experiences was very different, showing you if you come from a privileged background, it's going to be a very different entree than from Lincoln, just sort of having to put himself forward. And it came in part because there was a student when I was speaking about the leadership of FDR, or I think it might have been Lincoln, who raised from the White House, and he raised his hand. He said, how can I ever become one of them? It's too far removed if you're a young person. They're on Mount Rushmore. They've already accomplished things. So I thought if I start when they're young and they run the first time, then they're going to fail, as Lincoln does, you know, and they're going to struggle, and they'll get a swelled head for a while, as Teddy Roosevelt does. And they may not even go into public life until a little later, which is true for FDR. And Johnson seems to have been, a political figure from the time he's 5 years old. But maybe that people could identify with their struggles more. I mean, I loved it when Lincoln was announcing that first time when he's 23 that, you know, he really hoped this would happen. But if it didn't, he was too familiar with the disappointment to be very much chagrined. And then he promises that even if he lost, he'll run 5 or 6 more times until it's too humiliating, and then he will stop running. So anyway, that informed the first part. And then to go back and see what made them go into public life when they were young, where that ambition came from, how many of your qualities are inborn and how many are developed over time. Those are the big fun questions. And then I realized that all of them had gone through a really tough challenge, adversity in their lives. It hit them at different moments in their lives. So that's why the chapters are not all the same length in that part. I just wanted to wait till that hit them. Literature and leadership often talks about how coming through adversity makes one grow and a stronger leader. And that certainly turned true for them. And then when I got them into the presidency, I couldn't decide. I didn't want to study the whole presidency. And then the book would have been 1,000 pages and would have broken somebody's nose again, like it did with Bully Pulpit. The woman was falling asleep and reading Bully Pulpit, and she broke her nose with it.
Oh, so ouch.
I figured if I just chose the pivotal moment in each one of those presidencies, I mean, there could have been others to be chosen, but that's what I chose. And then they happened to illustrate different kinds of leadership that would give a coherence to it. And then all the traits that they develop over time are going to come into play in that big, turbulent, challenging moment, and then finally have them die in the epilogue, which was the hardest chapter to write in a way. You get involved with these people. And one of the things that happened to me, even in the writing of this book, I used to feel when I'd leave Franklin Roosevelt, I would have left for Abraham Lincoln and then Abraham Lincoln for Teddy and Taft. I used to feel guilty. I was leaving the guy behind like my old boyfriend somehow. And this way I got to keep them all together and look at them in a different way. So it was really fun to see the differences and the strengths and the samenesses and really think about this topic, which is so interesting, of leadership.
You, at first look, you read the four names and you think to yourself, oh, which one of these doesn't belong? Does Johnson belong in the list with the Roosevelts and Lincoln? I'm curious as to how much of a discussion that was in your own mind and how much was it influenced by actually working with the man?
I think, both things are true. I had to tell myself in my own mind that he belonged because of what he did domestically. When I think about it now, 50 years later, it comes into even sharper focus in terms of those three great civil rights laws, ending segregation in the South, voting rights, fair housing, Medicare, Medicaid, PBS, NPR, immigration reform. I mean, it's astonishing what happened in those 18 months. And his ability to get through Congress, which no president has been able to do since, seemed to me an important thing to understand in today's broken Washington. And I knew that I'd have to add a coda, which I did on Vietnam, to try and understand how this extraordinary strength in domestic leadership was not mirrored in the epic failure of Vietnam leadership. But I think it's also true that this is the first president I ever knew. And there's no question that spending those years with him in the White House and then accompanying him to his ranch to help him on his memoirs was instrumental in making me understand sort of the inner pressures that a president is feeling. I was so against the war in Vietnam, and though he didn't change my feeling about the war, I developed more empathy for him, watching him in those last sad days, trying to figure out could things have been different, and talking endlessly about civil rights as the hope that that's what he would be remembered for. So I think I would have felt a sense of loss if I hadn't included him. I've always had this worry that in the afterlife, there would be a panel of all the presidents that I've ever studied, and every single one will be telling me every single thing I missed about them. But the first person to scream out would be Lyndon Johnson. How come that damn book on the Kennedys was twice as long as the book you wrote about me? So if I hadn't put him in, I have a feeling he would have been talking to me. But I'm glad I did include him, because in some ways, he's an outlier. In the sections about how you treat a team and the importance of emotional intelligence and you know, sharing credit and treating them with kindness and holding their hands when needed to be. And then he's at times publicly humiliating the team members. You know, there's that one moment where he says, whose kid is writing to his mother, can't you do that and take a crap on your own time? And then he sees a desk that's, you know, disorganized, and he'll think the guy's disorganized. If it's not cluttered and it's too neat, he'll think the guy's lazy. They worked for him, and that I had to figure out, how did these teams, like when he was at the NYA, they were one of the best national youth administrations in the country. And I think it's because he set an example, you know, that he would come earlier than any of them, stay later. He gave them a reason. They were doing something that mattered a lot, that they were putting a lot of people to work. And they felt that sense of a mission. If you don't have that, you know, then that kind of behavior would never work, the bad boss. So that was fun, too, to have him out there as a contrast sometimes. I mean, sometimes doing extraordinarily and sometimes just being different from the other three.
Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest. The name of the new book is Leadership in Turbulent Times. It is out today from Simon and Schuster. I'm curious, as you were telling us about Lyndon Johnson, you did say that this is the president that you knew. You knew him. And yet, you really know all these guys, don't you? I mean, you have spent years and years working on detailed biographies of all these men.
No, I'd like to think so, yes. I mean, when you spent, it took me longer to write the book about Lincoln and the Civil War than it took the Civil War to be fought, longer to write about Franklin and Eleanor than World War II, 7 years to write about Teddy and Taft. I mean, it's crazy. I've not written 40 books like some of my fellow historians. So these guys, I think about them in the morning. I wake up with them at night. And that was why it was fun to realize that even though I knew a lot about them, I knew I hadn't thought about them directly in this way. You know, it's more personal to try and get inside and figure out, why did they feel confident or why did they not feel confident? Where did their, or even some of the subjects when I chose the 100 days for the presidency of FDR, I hadn't studied that at all because it was World War II that I wrote about. So all of that meant learning new things, which is the best part of writing these books.
So in writing this book, you are obviously looking at leadership, and you're looking at leadership traits. So give us a sense of what you think of some of the most important traits are that we see in this quartet.
Well, I think, you know, I would argue that among traits, I mean, there's traits and then there's patterns of behavior, you know, and I think among traits, empathy is critical. I mean, that means being able to see other people's points of view. And I think Lincoln was born with that. When you see him not wanting to put hot coals on turtles to make them wriggle like his fellow friends were doing, it was inside of him as a feeling. And Teddy said he developed that fellow feeling by getting away from his privileged background and just getting to know other people in the tenements or in the slums. And clearly FDR developed that empathy when he got polio and was close to people to whom fate had also dealt an unkind hand. Resilience is an essential core quality to be able to come through those challenges, not only in personal life, but in what happens in public life. And I think humility, you know, the understanding of your own limitations, even though all these people have a certain level of confidence and cockiness, you know, they're going to make mistakes. And then do they have the humility to be able to acknowledge them and then learn from those mistakes? And then the others are kind of patterns, like creating a team where you're really listening to other people who have strong-minded positions and being able to control negative emotions, you know, which would have some relevance today, I think, as FDR and Lincoln did amazingly with the hot letters and the drafts of speeches that they never sent. And somehow making decisions without going back over and over in your mind, finding out ways to sleep at night. A lot of these things, what interested me was that it's things that appeal to us as everyday people, you know, to figure out how had these people learned to relax. I mean, that's one of the most important qualities, I think, to replenish one's energy, especially in our world. It seems impossible, but, you know, if our days seem frenzied, they're certainly not as frenzied as they were for these guys. And they will manage to go, as Lincoln did, to the theater 100 times. You know, or FDR had a cocktail party every night in the White House where you couldn't talk about the war. Teddy spent 2 hours exercising every afternoon. So if they found time to do that, we can perhaps find time to be away from the iPhones for a few minutes.
In reading the book, though, and listening to the list that you just mentioned and some of the highlights there, it brings me, I guess, to a dual question, which is, what happens if we as Americans and we as citizens don't find those values in a leader important? And that attached to the question of if the assigned leader does not find those values important.
Well, you know, I think, number one, years ago when Tim Russert was still alive, the two of us talked about how campaigns were covered. And this was on his show, not the Meet the Press show, but his own cable show. And we sort of drew up a list of maybe 10 traits and patterns of behavior. And we were trying to think about a campaign where the journalists would be looking at all the leaders because they would know where they'd come from. Most of them at that time, except for Trump's an outlier again, because he's had no real leadership, much less political experience. But most of the time, you've got a governor, a senator, a mayor, a cabinet member. And instead of just looking at who gives, you know, the best mark in a debate and zings somebody or who raises the most money, if it's possible to just really study and look back and talk to their staffs and see how they dealt with the adversity, how they included people, how they communicated, all the things you care about, we should be voting on that. I think it's probably one of the most important things. In some ways, it's even more important than what they promise they're going to do. If you don't know that their word is any good, then what good does it do to promise something? So there is a problem if people no longer see these kind of leadership strengths as important in a public leader. And I think that's true, perhaps, of the people who support Trump and may not feel he has. I mean, more people feel he's dishonest and yet still support him, some of those people. And I think that's what we have to figure out, is how are we looking at our leaders? And that's what I'm hoping from history. If you look back at these four people, even though they all have their own flaws, that there is a sense of, you know, there's a sense of authentic leadership and a sense of a bond with the people. And clearly the people had a lot to do with it too. I mean, when Lincoln was told he was the great liberator, he said, no, the anti-slavery people did it all. And you could say that about the progressive movement that underlay Teddy and Franklin Roosevelt, the civil rights movement for LBJ, the women's movement, the gay rights movement. So change is not just from the leader's point of view. It's always a two-way street. And that's why I think we have to throw it back on the citizens today and really make them hopefully understand what leadership has looked like in the past so that we don't lose that imagination that it's possible to have that again.
You quote Lincoln in the book as saying, with public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed.
And I think that's right. I mean, I think that's why, you know, in the end, you know, if we're despairing at the way Washington looks right now, you know, it's up to us to change, not just the leaders that are there, but we really need a political structural revolution. And obviously campaign financing has to be changed. Everybody knows it. You know, whether that means Citizens United gets undone by an amendment, whether congressional districts can be done by nonpartisan means, whether you can figure out ways that people can interact. The thing that Teddy says about different sections in different regions of the country, unless they can look at each other with fellow feeling, then democracy's in trouble. I've often thought about national service programs to supplement the military service, knowing that military service is one place where people really do interact across class and section lines. But as Roosevelt said, these problems are created by man. They can be saved and changed by man. It's just a matter of our having the trust, you know, that we can do something in it again.
I was reading your book as the Kavanaugh hearings were going on, and it just struck me that we seem to ask that question about leadership almost in every facet of our government. So we ask it about the White House, where is the leadership? We ask it about the House, we ask it about the Senate, but we also ask, where is the leadership in the Democratic Party? Where is the leadership in the Republican Party? Has that always been a part of us as a nation, or is that a new wrinkle?
I think it is a somewhat new wrinkle. I mean, I think, you know, if you look back, you know, even 30, 40 years to the 60s and the 70s, you know, there were majority leaders, minority leaders. There was a presidential leader in LBJ, and the House and the Senate did extraordinary joint activity, bipartisan activity. Even under Ronald Reagan, there was some bipartisan activity. and it's just hardened in these last years much more than it was before, so that, you know, the people from the other side of the aisle treat each other as tribal characters. And they used to stay in Washington before they ran home to get the funds, and they would play poker and drink together. Their spouses got to know each other. So there was a collegiality in those days. And maybe part of it had to do with the fact that a lot of people in Congress in the 50s had gone through World War II together or the Korean War. So, again, they knew what it was like to fight for a common mission. But there was a pride in being a congressman or a senator there, that the institution mattered to you as well as what you were doing with policy. And now you just feel that less. And I think what happens is, just like people get used to war for so long, they no longer know what peace is. You know, we're used to this polarized situation in Washington for so long that a lot of the congressmen and senators, I can't imagine they're feeling joy in their work the way you would if you were there, you know, in the 1960s or the 1930s, or even weirdly in the 1860s, when you knew you were fighting for something that really matters. And so that is the question of who's going into public life, who's staying in public life. And that's the encouraging thing now about a lot of young people or older people who had not run before, but had been leaders perhaps as teachers or leaders in a medical establishment, running for office, and especially the record-breaking number of women running this time. So maybe with an infusion of people who have not been poisoned by this atmosphere and gotten so used to not getting anything done and not having any, you know, relationships with the other side, maybe they'll go in a different way. That's one hopeful thing.
Doris Kearns Goodwin's new book is Leadership in Turbulent Times. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. She's going to be almost everywhere. You have, I was looking at your tour, 32 stops in 2.5 months.
I don't know what I did. the queer thing is I really do like it. I mean, I love meeting the people and talking to them. That's the fun, you know, when they come up to sign books. The trouble is I take so long because I really want to find out about them as well as just sign my stupid name so quickly. And I get energy from it. It's just the imagining of it is harder than what it'll be once I actually start, I think.
Well, the book is out today, and then it all starts. Again, Doris Kearns Goodwin's new book is Leadership in Turbulent Times. She will be at the FDR Presidential Library in Hyde Park this Saturday at 3 o'clock. On September 29th, she'll be speaking at the Albany Book Festival at the University of Albany. And later in the day, she will be in conversation with me at the Maple Street School for a Northshire Bookstore event. The third time we'll be doing that, believe it or not.
I know.
Third
you
book.
Been through much of life together. I'm so glad I'll be seeing you again.
It's very exciting. It's in Manchester Center, Vermont. You can find out about all of the events by going to Doris's website. It's doriskearnsgoodwin.com. I can't wait to see you. Thank you very much for spending time with us, and best of luck with the start of the tour.
Same to you, Joe. I'll see you soon.
A great
Take
pleasure.
Care.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Leadership in Turbulent Times. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.